Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today, Tim Tatton-Brown is talking about the history of Salisbury Cathedral.
Good afternoon. Let me just try the sound. Yes, I don't have to talk very loudly. That's perfect. It's a huge pleasure to come here on my doorstep, because I just live over the hill, of course, and to do a lecture about Salisbury Cathedral, because I'm no longer working at the cathedral, but I had more than 25 years, I think, as the consultant archaeologist. And I was hugely lucky, because when I was asked to take on the job as the first consultant archaeologist, 1990, I think it was, 30 years ago nearly, by Hugh Dickinson, the dean, the whole, and many of you will remember this, the whole of the tower and spire, as well as other parts of the cathedral, were covered in scaffolding. So my work as an archaeologist started at the top, literally, on the spire, and I could crawl around the outside and look at it while the work was going on there. And I can't resist saying that because I'm an archaeologist by training, though I have only a degree in Roman archaeology, I've always been into buildings. I moved from Roman buildings, which I was particularly interested, to medieval buildings by luck, because I was, in 1975, the first director of the Canterbury Archaeological Trust, and by accident, I was allowed to go up in the roofs of Canterbury Cathedral by the then dean. Those were the days, no health and safety, just gave me the key, and you just, I climbed the spiral stairs, and I poked around, came down, told the vergers were out, and that was it. That, you would never do that nowadays, but that got me into cathedrals. And when I'd done 10 years running the Canterbury Trust, I then went freelance, and I was able to also work at Rochester and Chichester and then Westminster Abbey and so on. Won't go on all of that. And Salisbury is where my parents had lived. Well, they came here in 1972, so I first got to know the cathedral. My mother was even head of the flowers for 10 years at that time. So I, as we'll see, I know the back of the cathedral where she started a little garden for the, or for the cut flowers and all of that. So I've known Salisbury as well as anywhere for very many years, and I've lived in Salisbury after my parents died since 93. So it's been a huge pleasure working there. And amazingly, a lot of people said, why do you need an archaeologist at Salisbury Cathedral? It's a one period building on a virgin site. There is nothing for you to dig. And that sums up what archaeologists are supposed to be. And of course, if you're a prehistorian, well, you do have a few stones on the plain, but everything else is underground. And I had to sort of show that there was a need for an archaeologist to untangle the sequence of building and so on. And so what I'm going to try and say very briefly now, is a little bit of what I tried to write 11 years ago now in this book, which you've seen for the Dean and Chapter, about the whole history of the fabric in relation to the building history and then what happened later. And I'm going to concentrate today on the earlier part, though I will certainly say a little bit about the Tower and Spire, though that is a lecture in its own right, or several. Because what many people don't realise is that exactly 800 years ago, this year, in 1219, the work on building the cathedral started, amazingly. The date most people know is what no doubt will be celebrated April of next year, which is when the laying of the great stones by the good and the great, the king, the archbishops, other bishops, they all came to Salisbury. And that was the first great service on the new site. So that will, I'm sure, be well celebrated next year. But the actual work, as we'll see in a minute, started in 1219. The Pope had said, yes, everything was right. John was dead. There was a young king who was very young. Everything was perfect to build this amazing building, which went up rapidly in about 40 years. But let me just go back a little bit to the background, because you need to know this to know why this happened. Now, many people here will certainly, if you're from the local area at least, know this is 3 miles north of Salisbury, And all the pictures, I must say from the beginning, by my friend John Crook, which are all in the book, were taken especially for the book. And these were taken in an army helicopter from Middle Wallop. I'm told that wouldn't be allowed today. Drones are what you would have to have. And so John had a wonderful training exercise. We just flew around, said, right a bit, left, now let's go to Old Sarum, let's look at the close. So the aerial photographs are that. Anyway, that's beside the point, but John's pictures are the majority. There are a few other plans and so on. This is the famous Old Sarum, which again, one could do many lectures in one's own right, but how many people realize at the end of the 13th century, this was densely occupied, including down the hill in the background, across the Hudson Field area where there's a Holloway, that was a great street in a huge town. And so the whole of this area was densely occupied. The big problem was in the middle was this royal castle. And by the end of the 12th, early 13th century, with a huge population, that wasn't the right thing to have. Also, it was on top of the hill. Everybody will know you had to get the water from Stratford Sub Castle or a hugely deep well. It was freezing in the winter, there were no trees, etc. But already there was this magnificent great castle in the centre. I just put this on because I'm not going to say much about it. This castle basically is Bishop Roger's castle of the 12th century. But the great big keep, which you can see the bottom of, and it must have towered, it'd be great if that could be rebuilt in inverted commas again, then the views would be spectacular. This was the keep built at the time of the first of the great Norman bishops, Osmond, later Sir Osmond, and we will see him. And then the courtyard house was Bishop Roger, and as we'll see in a minute, we can even, because they're in Salisbury Cathedral, show you pictures of both those two great bishops of the 12th century. What they did, the castle is just bottom right here. This was an excavation, again, it's very appropriate, took place 100 years ago, or just over now, and was curtailed by the First World War under Sir William St. John Hope, one of the great architectural historians, archaeologists of the turn of the 1920th century. The main thing you can see on this drawing, and I can't go into the details, is that the black is the nave of Osmond's Cathedral, and you can just see the lines marked out of the apses, so it was quite a small cathedral, and then it was hugely enlarged, just like Winchester Cathedral at the same time, with the great transept with aisles on either side. If you want to know what that looked like above ground, rather than just walking there, go to Winchester Cathedral, where you can see the same. And the bishop by then, the new bishop, had to move outside, so he built this massive palace with a 100-foot-long great hall. And this was Bishop Jocelyn, who was 45 years bishop, so, you know, not there for a few years only. And the cloister was the covered way to get to the cathedral from the bishop's palace and some of the other houses here. And that's why Salisbury has the earliest cloister of a non-monastic cathedral. So this was all up and going. Here they are. These are now at the west end of the nave on the south side, rather overlooked because the guides all stand there and take you off on your tour. These are exceptionally early, rare survivals. The reason is that they are the lids of stone coffins that were brought down, we know exactly, in 1226, once the first bit of Salisbury, the new cathedral, had been built. This is made of Tournai marble, black Tournai marble, Belgian marble, but the head somehow got smashed and is replaced with a later Purbeck marble head. That's Bishop Roger, and this is Jocelyn, the 45 years, and there's even an inscription telling all about him on it, but you can go and see that in the cathedral. And the third bishop, Osmond, was also brought down, not yet a saint, but already from the end of the 12th century, a quasi-saint. He was called Blessed Osmond. He hadn't been canonized. And this amazing structure, and I was privileged to take part in the dismantling of this in the nave, where it had been put in the late 18th century, and rebuilding it on the site of where it had been until the late 18th century from 1226. This is also a coffin lid. The coffin, unfortunately, is gone. And it was because, as you can fairly obviously see, people wanted to get close to the sacred man, Osmond, And so its technical name is a foramina shrine, but people get their heads in there. This is amazing too, because this is the only one to survive. There was an almost identical shrine to this in Canterbury Cathedral for Thomas Becket, the original one. You can see it in the stained glass in the pictures, but Henry VIII had it obliterated. And ultimately, it is based on the tomb of Christ in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which also had holes in it, but it's now an early 19th century shrine if you've been to Jerusalem. So these are a very important background to Salisbury Cathedral. And the most amazing thing of all, in a way, is here's again one of John's splendid photographs from the army helicopter. There is the close. Many will know that, the biggest close in England, and then the town beyond it. And apart from a few not nice things like the bypass and so on, there it is. And this developed rapidly, the close and the town, in the early 13th century. And the reason that Salisbury, actually is a town, and by the late Middle Ages, was probably the sixth or seventh largest town in England from nothing, because there was no town here before, which is remarkable. I mean, okay, that's another story, the wool and all the rest. But what started it off was the building of the cathedral. The close, we know, was already being laid out in around 1198-99, but then there was a little problem. I think you've got a lecture on this. There was the Third Crusade, and all those on the bishop by that time was Hubert Walter, famously had a little chat with Salah ad-Din. Richard Coeur de Lion didn't meet him and took people to the, once they'd lost, they couldn't take Jerusalem, took them. That was the Bishop of Salisbury. He was the chaplain to the forces in modern terms in the Third Crusade. He was the one who obviously started to get things going. He then goes on to be Archbishop of Canterbury, famous archbishop. And it is Richard Poore, it's complicated, and he was the younger brother of Herbert Poore, the bishop succeeding Hubert Walter, who laid out the plots. We have documentary evidence. The canons were saying, you know, come and choose your plot. The bishop obviously got the big plot to the south here, like at Old Sarum, opposite the cloister, and then the dean was opposite the west front. Otherwise, they were all nice plots. The best were always, and the biggest were always on the west. But not only that, was that, so broadly, that, and I should say it was laid out as a rectangle of consecrated ground, as it still is today. There are thousands of burials in there, a road around the outside, and then the house plots running back, and then a wall, which then gets fortified and made stronger in the 14th century. And there's a problem slightly in that they then build the best crossing point to the river, the Aylesway Bridge, which is within what was supposed to be the close. It's all part of the Liberty. So that everybody using it from the town came down Exeter Street, left and right and then left. Unlike today, there's the 1932 bridge. But beyond that, as you can see from this early 18th century map, which pretty well shows the whole medieval town, this town was growing up rapidly, and certainly the reason it grew up rapidly was the vast amount of stone and other materials and workmen of the highest order. I always like to think of Salisbury when the cathedral was being built in the early 13th century as like, even somewhere like, a bit of an exaggeration perhaps, Cape Canaveral. It was where the best people in England were coming to build what is going to be the most fabulous building they've ever put up from scratch. And you can see that just because the masonry of the cathedral is ashlar masonry, squared stones throughout, outside and inside, rubble core. Only one little bit of the cloister doesn't have that. That is total Rolls-Royce treatment. And so all those people, obviously they were masons, smiths, carpenters, hundreds of labourers, and some very skilled people, of which the most important, again, one can do a lecture on him alone, Elias de Dereham, who was a canon from the beginning, from 12, 20, 25 years, who was the custos of the fabric. He received the stuff. He clearly was involved in the design. He had, by the way, just previously designed the new shrine of Thomas Becket for 1220 in Canterbury Cathedral. along with the goldsmith. So obviously Alastair Dereham did the design, the goldsmith did all the gilding and all the nice carving and all the rest of it. And he came here, Richard Poore brought him here, and he was the one who supervised the work. Now let's get to the archaeology, the nitty-gritty. Everybody who knows Salisbury Cathedral knows this is just near the north porch, and this bit of concrete and this great gutter was put here by Scott, G.G. Scott, in the Great Restoration when they lowered the ground level, made it all tidy and nice grass as it is today. But he over-lowered it because at the bottom, the 13th century ground level was here. This is the top of the actual plinth, well, the basically the foundation. Here's a sketch. I couldn't resist putting this in. This was drawn by a long-serving clerk of works of the cathedral who showed me this when they were digging part of it down to the gravel bed, which shows exactly the foundations. I have to put this in because it's a complete myth that says Salisbury Cathedral was built in a marsh and it was daft. That is completely wrong. It is built in a floodplain where we do have floods, not very often. January 1915, the nave was flooded. But they were very lucky. They dug 5 feet down onto a bed of gravel, glacial gravel, 25 feet thick, they didn't know that, and chalk underneath. So a perfect natural raft foundation. So when people say, look, there's a 400-foot high spire on a 5-foot foundation, they must be mad. Rubbish. They just were lucky to go down to that. In Winchester Cathedral, in a Roman city, all sorts of problems underground. The whole cathedral moved all over the place. The tower fell down, you know, and they've never been able to build anything high. Maybe the longest cathedral, but Salisbury, the opposite, hence the tower and spire. The other thing, and I just put in detail here, most people don't know, Salisbury Cathedral is the flattest cathedral in England, no crypt or anything, but there are two original steps which are very important. Here's one of them. And notice the way the bench along the wall goes up over the steps. And it's very clear that the whole cathedral was laid out from the beginning, 475 or so feet long, and the foundation trenches were dug, and they built the lowest bit of the wall up to the bench top. Because, and again, I can't go into all, you can show this was done from west to east. The west end of the cathedral, where the three doors were, where there were steps up and down, was the starting point. And they built the whole of the, here we are, the whole of the lowest part to the bench, right the way throughout. So it was always one. It wasn't as one assumes. Automatically and obviously they would do the east end first and go west. That's what then happened. And so this plan, again, I haven't time to, and it's probably not very visible, but the bench differs and there are various things which show that the whole of the building was built very rapidly from absolutely from 1220, the foundations, I should say, and that I've just shown you were going in from 1219, hence it's 800 years. As soon as they'd done that, which was in probably the first year or so, they then started at the east end, the Trinity Chapel, because, of course, the cathedral is dedicated to the Virgin, so you can't have a lady chapel, but the lady mass was always there, and the two chapels on either side, as far as, well, two bays along. And there it is. Again, I can't go into all the details, but this wonderful space at the east end was very rapidly put up. The three eastern chapels were complete and roofed, if I... I got those in, but I'll come back to in a minute. But basically, unfortunately, the central roofs have been replaced in the 18th century, but this roof here and the one on the other side are original. They're the earliest roofs, as we will see in the cathedral, and the timber has been dendrochronologically dated. Some of it even came from Ireland, southeast Ireland, south of Dublin, to the early 1220s. So they were already getting timbers, and we know it was shipped from Dublin to Bristol and then brought overland right from the beginning. The other thing you can just about make out is the masonry of the lowest part looks a bit of a sort of mishmash, and that's true because there are various different stone types there because they were collecting it up. Once you get to the main cathedral and you ignore all the restoration, the Scots stuff, it's a very uniform stone that certainly, it's always been called Chilmark stone. It doesn't actually come from Chilmark, because Chilmark is an underground post-medieval area of mines famous for the RAF and bombs and all of that. It actually comes from the Tisbury wider area, and in the woods around Tisbury, one can see the remains of where the quarries were from the disturbed ground. Huge quantities. You don't go underground if you want to build something this big and you can get the stone from the surface. So once they got it sorted out in the first 2 years, they could build very rapidly. Again, these are immensely important, unique to Salisbury Cathedral in the proper sense of the word, not nearly unique or very unique or anything like that. They're just unique. On the outside, they are stone discs, and they have been put into the masonry as part of the construction. You see how the coursing of the stone, beautiful thin joints. Almost certainly, and I've written a long article about this, these are the so-called foundation stones laid in April of 1220, when all the good and the great came. And basically you can see that's very well preserved. That's the center of the east wall. They had brasses, as they're called, Latin, L-A-T-E-N, the name, a bronze, a phosphor bronze, just like brasses, you know, which you rub. Unfortunately, all probably robbed in the 17th century, but you can see the fixings. On the inside, this is in the inside, unfortunately over repainted with modern colour in the 20th century, they cut slots into the masonry. You see, it's coursed through. These, I think, are 1258, when the cathedral was finished, and these are the ones that were laid at the beginning. Again, I've only very rough, and I could explain in more detail if you're interested, but that needs more work. The most interesting thing, which I couldn't find a slide of, is there's one on the south, which is a lozenge, not a circular disc, which usually later on heraldically means a woman. And in fact, it's quite likely that we can't prove it. It was Countess Ella, the wife of the great Earl, who we know was there at the stone placing ceremony. And so, amazingly, you actually have a woman commemorated. It's not all modern, women were very important if they were the wives of earls and counts and so on. But the key thing is, again, I must go into these, there's a ritual which had been long before worked out. These had to be consecrated by the bishop. They had to be 7 feet above the ground. This hole, you can just about see here, is where there was a metal candle holder for a candlestick. There are lots of manuscripts showing this. And you would climb a little ladder, because 7 feet is quite high. And so that was the ceremony that was taking place in April 1220. And I should have said also, the ritual says you have to have three crosses on each of the cardinal points, three on the north, three south, three east, three west. If I quickly go back, if you can just see, the crosses on the east are the three marked, do you see, with three, I can't see it really, there. Two transepts, so there are two crosses on the buttresses, corner buttresses there, and a third one there, because you only have three. The same on this side. The one that's probably or possibly Countess Ella is here. And then a problem at the west end, because that was done a bit later, and you can see the main one in the gable above. So that's the ritual, and that then set off. And the only one amazingly survived, and we only were able to have it cleaned 20 years ago, at the east end on the inside. That's all original medieval colour because it was behind a reredos of a much later altar in the Trinity Chapel. So that's all original medieval colour. Now, what they then built, and I've just mentioned, these three eastern chapels are extraordinary work. It was called a basilica, and what you've got are these incredibly slender Purbeck marble shafts, which are incredibly, early for this sort of work. The iron ties above, that are slightly messed up by electrical cables and things on them, those are original, the fixings to the tops of the capitals. And basically, this was clearly a really important space. And Richard Poor, from the beginning, quite clearly wanted the shrine of St. Osmond here. Everybody was doing it. They got a new shrine in Worcester Cathedral, which he went and helped dedicate, and so on and so forth. Of course, Becket Shrine was the jackpot chime, so to speak, and he wanted this. Unfortunately, though, that's another story, after a few years, he was forced against his will to go to Durham, where there was a massive squabble between monks and bishop. And because he was such a great bishop, he had to sort it out. The Pope personally sent him, sort out Durham, and he went there in 1228, wanting to stay here. And of course, he was brought back to Dorset, his home county, to be buried in 1237. So others took over, but he'd set the whole ground plan. And this, amazingly enough, this is to show this beautiful, I'm very fond of Purbeck marble. Geologists will say it's not a marble because geology defined marble as a stone that had been under huge pressure and all the rest of it, and Carrara is a white marble. This is a freshwater limestone, but in the Middle Ages, marble just meant polished. This is a Gilbert Scott restoration, but it's superbly done in the 19th century. It was very worn here because of the early destructive stuff, but you can just make out these are the little snails, freshwater snails. If you go, as I have done, to see where the marble is got out of the ground, I've helped Trev Haysom, who's the only marbler who can supply it today. I've seen it. You can see dinosaur or iguanodon footprints in the freshwater. You know, people say, why is it freshwater, not seawater? Well, these are freshwater snails, and you can see them walking around the swamp. So it's a superb material, and it's great we can still acquire this marble. This was a beautiful drawing done for me by a lovely man, Aless, died only a short time after he did this for me, one of the great draftsmen working for English Heritage and the Ministry of Works beforehand, of roughly trying to reconstruct what the first phase of the work was. And it's also cut away. Basically, you know, it's not just at one date. The main thing is to show how the three chapels were up and in use. The bodies of the three bishops, Osmond, with that great foramina shrine, and the other two you've just seen were brought down and put here in 1226. This was all finished in 1225. We even have, and I'll show you detail, the northern chapel, which showing the original roof, is filled solid. The vault pockets are great holes, but not there. And I think, yeah, this is the original early 1220s roof, rafters, scissor braces, and so on. And the whole thing was filled in, and though it's unfortunately broken up surface now, it was almost certainly where the actual guys who were doing the designs of the masonries were working, what they call a tracing floor. It had a gypsum top. One survives above the north porch at Wells Cathedral, and there are a few others. There's one in York and so on. Unfortunately, and we did have a look, it has, I think, 100% been destroyed, and you can't see traces of it. But it's amazing, the roof, as I say, we've dendrodated that, survives. And in the cathedral, we have the earliest, I think, known Arabic numerals used. Mostly, this period, they were still using Roman, 111s, X's, and all the rest of it. But the carpenters here, who were certainly not any old labourers, incredibly skilled people, were using Arabic numerals. There are manuscripts with earlier Arabic numerals in England, but not, as far as I know, any on carpentry. This then happened. This, to me, is the miracle. What happened after that was done? We know that cranes were brought in the autumn of 1226. That's finished. The three bishops have been reburied. They started to go up to 90 feet above the ground. And this is another of John's fine pictures from the Triforium level, obviously looking northeast, to show you what they were then building from that point, from 12, beginning the work proper start, 1227, and was certainly complete by 1240 or so. Earlier, the shell would have been finished in the middle of the 1230s. So effectively, 7 or so years to build this extraordinary eastern arm with the eastern transept, you see. The scissor arches come in a little bit later, but otherwise all this is built, Purbeck marble everywhere. Well, I couldn't resist seeing the Willis organ still in situ. I love the organ music, but I couldn't really hear it. I'm a huge fan of the organ and the organ music, so it's great that that is now being rebuilt. And I love going to cathedrals when you can only hear organ music and not a lot of tourists talking. Sorry, that's very naughty. And so I'm waiting till David, my old friend, David the organist, has got his spectacular organ back. I hope it then doesn't get, no, I mustn't even mention that, but a Notre Dame where the organ's intact but full of smoke and water, but that's horrendous. Anyway, then having done the eastern arm, the most important place, which is where the services were going to take place, had to be sorted out as quick as possible. And we know this was done by the early 1240s from various documents and so on. And broadly what they're doing, and you've still got it today, but restored by Scott, on the west, because this is the crossing down here, there was a screen. We know that the choir stalls behind there were made with timber from Chippenham Forest, supplied in 1236. So that says that obviously the stone screen and the main structure must have been pretty well done to be able to put the stalls in the next year or so. You then have the presbytery is the technical word, but this remarkable area that ends with the high altar with a great statue of the Virgin above it. The screen there is a later medieval thing, and there was actually a vestry, all of this stripped out in the late 18th century. Mad, but it all went. And if you go to Winchester, you have the same thing with a vestry behind the screen, the reredos above the high altar, and doors on either side. That all went. So this is a reconstruction. But I will point out here, because I won't come back, in the middle are three of my real heroes, apart from Richard Poore, the three bishops of Salisbury, covering the period 1297 till 1375, only three bishops. The one in the middle, you will all know, it has the magnificent brass that is now in the morning chapel, but was originally here. It was removed from here into the northern morning chapel in the 1660s, if I remember rightly, when they put new black and white marble paving in to be up to date. So that's been moved, but he was there, and he's between the two men who must have built the tower and spire. But I'll come back to them at the end. I must keep an eye on my timing, I know. The final bit of work in the nave is to produce these most sophisticated of all the piers. They're all different, and it's all Purbeck marble. These drum shafts here are also Purbeck marble, but they're not polished, so you can see the snails pretty well. And then quickly was added on in the 1240s. A hole was actually bashed, so they hadn't worked it out through the southeast transept, for the two most important things once the services start, the muniment room above and the vestiarium treasury, which is what still effectively goes on there today. Most people don't notice. Oh, this is the, dare I say, the garden that my mother started in the 70s when she was doing the flowers. And again, until 1970, so I've never seen it, all the chests, which are now sort of draped round, rather sadly, round the eastern ambulatory, were in here. Magna Carta was here and everything else. And there were double bars, shutters, which are still there, etc. But unfortunately, in 1970, much as I love him, Richard Seal came here as the organist and had the choir practice. And it's a lovely space. The floor is one of the rarest floors in England because it's a original 13th century tile pavement, covered up mostly, on a timber floor. First floor medieval tile pavements in situ are usually on vaulted structures, like at Lichfield or so on. This one is on a timber floor. The completion of the work with this amazing west front, again, we wrote a whole book about this 20 years ago when the scaffolding was there, so I won't go into detail, ending in what I can't resist telling you, because the new one is about to appear, Pevsner calls the west front of Salisbury Cathedral a headache. What did he mean? Well, he, of course, great master that he was, thought of Italy and all the rest of it, and the golden section, and if you go to, say, Bologna, you will see, I'm trying to remember the name of the church, but church where only the lowest bit is built, and there's a blank wall behind, because the facade was going up there. That, obviously, would be very carefully designed. This, as we were able to show, was not the case. All they did at the end on the west front, they followed the bands of decoration round, and when they needed to shift them up or down, you see the three lancets are the west window, the decoration is skied, and so on. So there's no logic to it for an art historian like Pevsner. It's just the way it's built up, but it's almost exactly 100 feet square. And so the general idea is, but in the 13th century, you know, they weren't in the Renaissance, so to call it a headache is, well, it's fun, you know, I don't know if it'll go in the new edition or not. And I couldn't say, this, alas, was the other great glory, which was destroyed in the 18th century, and you will probably, many of you will know, the foundations are visible, I think, now because of the patch marks by the, where the cafe, the new cafe is, English heritage, as everybody points out. But they cribbed this, I'm sure, their designer from Salisbury. It's not an ancient monument. It's nothing to do with English heritage, but it's a good logo. And then this 85-foot high masonry tower, you see, and then on top of that, amazing timber structure. And luckily, in the early 18th century, the great Salisbury carpenter Francis Price drew it. And that was Price's design when they'd already knocked this down to put a dome on the top after his hero and very much one of his mentors, Sir Christopher Wren, but that's a fantasy. That was never built, so that's what he suggested. But luckily, he drew the cross-section of this timber and lead structure. This was 200 feet high, so half the height of this, which is still, to me, even though I've seen it for so many years, a wonder. And to have the privilege now of looking at it, having climbed all around the outside of the tower on the scaffold, up on the hanging scaffolds, right up the top, I've looked out, not recently, the weather door where you can see on YouTube or whatever, up to the five capstones on the top. The whole of the top, by the way, was completely cut down 25 feet and rebuilt in 1950. You can see that in even an earlier autogyro shot when that was going on. And again, to talk about how it was built is not for today, but there is no doubt at all, this is the main structure used to build the spire. Some people have suggested, clever academics, and I can show why they're wrong, or I think I can, that no, this was put in the late 14th century. This is the early 14th century structure. It's not one great mast up the middle as it looks, but it's a series of layers, and you can see the planks. They built it from the inside out. You know, everywhere else you can see putlog holes where the scaffolding, the wooden scaffolding, the cathedral. Once you get here to the top of the tower, there are no putlog holes until you get to the very top. And then, of course, it's so narrow, you have to go out through the weather door, the north door, and the rungs are still there, where Gary, my old mate, goes and changes the aircraft warning light bulbs, which have been there since 1950 because of all the RAF and Boscombe Down and so on. So it's a wonderful continuity, but that is a separate lecture. There it is. It is amazing structure, and it is the high point, in my view, of all British architecture, the early 14th century. That's when the Ely Octagon was built. I won't go and list them all. The east end of Bristol Cathedral is now built at this time in the early 14th century during the chaotic reign of Edward II, when you would have thought, you know, and the wars with the Scots and all the rest of it. But this was when the great churchmen of the day were building really well and doing wonderful work. And Edward I particularly was trying to get all the money off them to go and beat up the Scots. He'd already done the Welsh. And it's and so out of that, these two men, and on the left is, because these are the tombs by the presbytery, on the left is the tomb of Simon of Ghent, 1297-1314. I meant to say on the previous one, just go, this is Ballflower, with even the base of the tower with a fleur-on trail. And they started to do it up here, and they thought, why on earth? Nobody can see this. But the only place where you will find that is here, on his tomb. This is on, you see, I can't see, but that's Ballflower on the side, and you see the fleur-on trail and flowers coming out. It's exactly the same style. We have no documentary evidence, I should say, for the building of the Tower of Spire. Unfortunately, it is all gone. So he started it, and very simplified, he took over. He'd been Dean of York, Dean of Lincoln, and building the timber and lead spire in Lincoln, even higher than this, came down and became bishop. This is Roger Martival, and he's even got miniature flying buttresses. He's got a sort of squashed drawing on top, this extraordinary structure. You look at it, it's not really three-dimensional, it's squashed. And this clearly reflects what he's doing. He's finishing the spire, and he's putting in all the buttresses that nobody notices to support it while this huge weight is crushing it down. And this was all finished probably by about 1330. Finally, and this again is another lecture, the East End, I should just mention the end of the story of Osman. This is a reconstructed plan of the East End before 1789, when they knocked down, unfortunately, the later chantry chapels of great Bishop Beauchamp and the Hunkham and so on. But the key thing here is the shrine. Beauchamp spent a lot of money getting the Pope, took a lot of money in those days, much more than the 13th century, finally to get him consecrated, Saint Osman, canonized in 1457. Shrine was built there. And because they then moved his bones out of where the foraminer shrine was, up here, it was empty, so it didn't get smashed up in the Reformation, unlike, obviously, the shrine itself. So it was only from 1457 till 1539, when it was knocked down, we had an actual saint of St. Osman. I was going to say something about, but I think I've already overstayed my time. We started late. So these are just to show how, in three diagrams, it evolved in the 17th, 19th, 20th century, and so on. There's the Scott Restoration, but you can see these, dare I say it, if you want, and see a discussion in the book. So I hope I haven't overspent my time too much, but that at least gives you a flavour. One of my absolute favourite, I am a bit biased, one of the greatest medieval buildings anywhere in, well, certainly Europe, if not in the world. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.